Les colloques du Collège de France.
So, welcome back, and for the last lecture of the afternoon, we will talk again about the bottom of the spectrum of some operators, but in a different context. The bass notes of arithmetic hyperbolic surfaces by Bram Petrie, who works in one Parisian university, but I'm not able. What's the name of Paris?
The one across the road from where
the
we
one
are.
The one.
All right. So, thank you very much for the invitation, Nalini. I'm talking about some joint work with Will Hyde about base notes of closed arithmetic hyperbolic surfaces. So, since this is supposed to be accessible to somewhat general audience, I'll slowly go through all of the words in the title at some point. But I want to start by just writing the theorem on the board. And then also during the talk, I'll explain what it says and explain some context. So the theorem is as follows, which is due to, so one version is due to Michael McGee, and the other one is due to us. And it states the following. It says that if you take lambda 1 of x, where x varies over all closed arithmetic hyperbolic surfaces, so x closed arithmetic hyperbolic surface, so this is a countable set of surfaces, so this is some countable set of real numbers. And the theorem is that if I close off this countable set of real numbers, I intersect it with the interval 0 to a quarter, then I get the interval 0 to a quarter. So this set of numbers intersected with 0 to a quarter is dense in interval 0 to a quarter. You can approximate every real number between 0 and a quarter with lambda 1s. Lambda 1 here is the first eigenvalue of the Laplacian lambda 1s of closed arithmetic hyperbolic surfaces. So this is what I want to explain. All right, so, and oh, sorry. And so, and so the background is that, so Michael McGee proved this for arithmetic surfaces in general without the word closed. So the contribution of Will and mine is that you can also do it with closed arithmetic surfaces. This was a question that Michael asked in his paper. And what we did, so towards the end of the talk, I hope to explain a little bit what goes into the proof. And I'll of course, our proof is very much inspired by some of what Michael did. I'll focus on what's different mostly. And then, but before I talk about any of that, I want to talk about some context. So this problem of determining sets of lambda ones of some family of geometric objects fits into a much larger context, which is that of studying base notes of families. This terminology is borrowed from a text by Sarnak. Families of uniform, locally uniform geometries. Locally uniform geometries. So this is, again, this is a, I think, introduced like this by Sarnak, very much inspired by work by Kravchuk, Mazach, and Paul, and independently Bonifacio. Sarnak has on his homepage has a nice set of notes called the Chern Lectures, where he discusses many examples of these problems. I just want to give you a couple. The one I want to start with is probably the most classical one, which is namely studying the set of base notes of flat tori of volume 1. So example 1. Flat tori of volume one. Okay. So a flat torus is a n-dimensional torus with a flat Riemannian metric on it. This is this always given by so fact every such torus is of the form Rn mod lambda, where lambda is a lattice, so nothing else than all integral linear combinations of some basis of Rn. Vi, this is a basis, and Rn is a lattice. Okay? I want my tori to be of volume one. This I can always realize by just scaling back the lattice. So this is not a very stringent condition. And the question we're going to ask is exactly the analog of that. So there's a Laplacian here, which is just usual Euclidean Laplacian. So xi squared. Okay. This is the Laplacian, and the question is just is the same thing. So what is the set? What is the set of base nodes of this family of geometric objects that locally all look the same? So this is nothing else. So again, so I'll this is the set of lambda ones Rn lambda, where lambda is a Rn is a lattice of covolume one. Okay, this is a question.
Base node is the first eigenvalue.
Yeah, base node will be base. Yeah, yeah.
Just to clarify.
Here, yeah, base node will be the the first non-trivial eigenvalue. So clearly, so the. So let me make it precise now. So this thing, the what's nice about flat tori is that we can describe the spectrum and the eigenfunctions very well. And so I imagine many of you have seen this, but the eigenfunctions here are given by the following. So this is phi v of x is e to the power 2 pi I inner product of x with v. So for fixed v, this determines a Laplacian eigenvalue eigenfunction on Rn, right? And if I want this expression also to make sense in the torus, then in Rn mod lambda, then I want that if I add up a lattice vector to x, that this the value of this function doesn't change. And so what do I want? I want that v lies in what is called the dual lattice, which is just a set of all vectors in Rn such that w, maybe let me call them v, sorry, v with w is in z for every w in my lattice. Okay, this is called the dual lattice because it's also a lattice, it is also of covolume one. So that's, and these are not just some eigenfunctions. These form orthogonal basis for L2, so they span all of them. And the corresponding eigenvalues you can also just compute. It's 4 pi squared times the norm of v squared, right? This is a matter of differentiating twice. So again, so the zero vector corresponds to constant functions, right? And the first, what I'm calling lambda one here, would be so the first non-trivial eigenvalue, which corresponds to the shortest dual vector, right? So lambda here, lambda one is nothing else than it's nothing else than the min of the 4 pi times the Euclidean length squared of v in the dual lattice, okay? But not zero, sorry. Okay. So if I'm asking this question here, this is completely equivalent to asking, since duality is an involution on the space of lattices, it preserves volume one. So I'm just asking, what is the set of possible shortest lattice vectors of lattices of volume one, which is an incredibly classical problem in the theory of lattices. So this is also so this is equivalent to shortest lattice vector problem. Lattice vector problem. It's also equivalent to the shortest lattice. My dual lattice also defines a torus. The vectors in my lattices define closed loops on the torus. So what I'm asking when I'm asking the shortest lattice vector, I'm asking what is the shortest closed geodesic on my torus. So it's also the problem of what is the maximal possible systole. Max systole of Rn. Okay, again, because I can forget about the dual here. Lambda lattice of co volume one. And then the last one, that is maybe the most.
Where did you say the maximum system?
Ah, very, very good point. This is a theorem. Lambda varies over the space of lattices. So the space of lattices is not compact. Systole is a continuous function, but a priori there's no reason that this should be a maximum rather than a supremum. But there's a theorem called Mahler compactness that says that this is a maximum. Was that the question?
I thought your original question was to describe the set of all the lambda
ones. You're right. I'm used to thinking of the maximum, but I want to describe. So I want, in supposed to describe it in the maximum. I want to describe. I want to describe all systoles, which is equivalent to describing the maximum because it's an interval by Mahler's compactness. The last version that I wanted to write down is it's also the same as the lattice packing density problem. What is the density of a packing in general? So packing in Rn is a collection of disjoint balls with equal radius, and density is the space it fills up. So density of lambda is I take all the balls of the equal radius around the vectors in my lattice. Of course, I'm going to take R maximal so that all these balls are disjoint, which corresponds to taking half the systole or half the shortest lattice vector. And I intersect with a ball of radius 0 around R. I take the volume of that density, and I compare that to the volume of the ball of radius R. This is some measure of which proportion of space it fills up. If you've never seen this, here's an exercise. This is the same as the volume of the ball of radius 1 in Rn divided by 2 to the power n times the systole of my lattice Rn lambda, divided by the volume of the co-volume of the lattice in general, to the power n, which I've normalized to be 1. Okay, so it's the same as understanding the maximal the densest lattice packing in Rn. This is all these problems is the same. And again, what do we know? Let me write this up. So Mahler compactness again. So the space of lattices in Rn is not a compact space. So a priori, it's not even clear that if you just ask for the maximum, that it's a maximum, but that's true. And that implies the following. It implies that the set, in terms of base notes, what I get, sort of flat n tor I, I get some interval, can't realize zero, right? There's no lattice with shortest vector zero. And then there's some real number a n, which depends on the dimension, of course. And we know it in dimensions. So even in the Euclidean setting, there's lots of open problems about this. This is known in dimensions 1 up to 8 and dimension 24. Because in dimension 24, there's a very special lattice called the Leech lattice, which sort of optimizes all these quantities. And up to dimensions 1 up to 8, it's also known, and then in between we don't. So even the fact that in dimension 24 the Leech lattice optimizes is, this is not so old, this theorem. I think it's from 2012 due to Cohn and Kumar. Okay, that the Leech lattice uniquely optimizes the density among lattices. And then by now we also know, due to works of Wiazowska with Cohn, Kumar, Miller, and Rodchenko, that the Leech lattice doesn't just optimize the density among lattices, but among all packings. But for us, I mean, if you look into general packings, this connection to spectral geometry gets lost, so I'll stick to lattices. Okay. So that's sort of the most classical example of this problem, the maximal density of a lattice packing. Okay, but I, of course, as the title suggests, I want to talk about hyperbolic surfaces. So so let me first remind you of a little bit of hyperbolic geometry. Okay, so just to be absolutely sure we're all on the same page, let me define what a hyperbolic surface is. So hyperbolic surface is a complete Riemannian two-manifold. So the quickest definition is to say it's a complete Riemannian two-manifold of constant curvature, constant sectional curvature equal to minus one. Constant curvature equal to minus one, okay? This is the quickest definition. You can also say it's still complete Riemannian and locally isometric to the hyperbolic plane, H2. And also the hyperbolic plane admits sort of a concrete definition and an abstract one. The hyperbolic plane, you can say, is the unique, simply connected hyperbolic surface. not very helpful, but it's true. But more concretely, you write down a model. So it's either the upper half plane in the complex plane with this Riemannian metric. So I'm not going to use the actual metric, but I'm writing it down just to convince you that this is very concrete. It's also, you can also think of this as the disk with the following Riemannian metric, the s squared up squared equals 4 dx squared plus dy squared over, x squared is y squared, okay? All right, so it's just locally isometric to this, meaning every point in my manifold has a little neighborhood that's isometric to some region in this, in the hyperbolic plane. Another equivalent definition, so I'm writing them down because I will use them a little bit. Another equivalent definition is to say it's the hyperbolic plane mod gamma, where gamma is a subgroup of the isometry group on the hyperbolic plane that acts properly, discontinuously, and freely, or otherwise stated, this is a Lie group, and you want that gamma is discrete, so as a topological subspace, it's discrete, and it's torsion-free, meaning there's no element of finite order in gamma, except the identity. Okay, this turns out this is also, this naturally has a structure of a hyperbolic surface, and vice versa, any hyperbolic surfaces of this form. Okay, so that's the definition. Let's give you, let's draw an example. So using the second definition, something locally isometric to the hyperbolic plane, what you can do is you can just take bits of hyperbolic plane and glue them together. So here's the disk. One way to do this is I can take a regular octagon in the disk. So by regular octagon, I mean the following thing. I mean that, first of all, it's an octagon whose sides are geodesic segments in the hyperbolic plane. So it turns out that geodesics in this model are half circles orthogonal to the boundary and diagonals through the origin. So these are supposed to be segments of those geodesics. It's regular in the sense that all the sides have the same length, and also all the angles, the interior angles, are the same. Note that so lengths are very distorted in the pictures, but the angles are the same because this metric is in the conformal class of the Euclidean metric on the disk. So the angles are the same, and I want the angle to be pi over 4 here. Okay, so it's a regular. It turns out, so with some hyperbolic trigonometry, it turns out that this up to moving out around the octagon by isometries, this determines a unique octagon in the hyperbolic plane. And what can I do? I can glue opposite sides together. Okay, so it's maybe not so hard to convince yourself, but if you've never seen it, it's not immediate. But this glues the octagon into a surface of genus 2. And because the sides of my octagon are geodesics, sort of the hyperbolic metric, this has a hyperbolic. In the image of the interior of the octagon, there's a nice hyperbolic metric, just a metric coming from the plane. And then in the interior of a side, I'm gluing two geodesics together. So it looks locally, it looks like I'm gluing two half spaces together like this. So this also here, I am creating regions that are locally hyperbolic. And then if you trace the side identifications, you'll notice that all the vertices get glued into a single point. And that's why I chose angle pi over 4, because a times pi over 4 is 2 pi. So that makes for a smooth point there too. Okay. So this surface, this is a special surface. It's called the Boltzmann surface. So also the Boltzmann surface admits a quicker definition than what I've just said. It's the unique closed hyperbolic surface of genus 2 with 48 orientation-preserving self-isometries. That's also a definition. Again, hyperbolic surfaces also, they are in one-to-one correspondence with Riemann surface structures on the surface. So the Boltzmann surface is also the unique Riemann surface, closed Riemann surface of genus 2 with 48 automorphisms. This is a possible definition too. And then you can imagine that I can sort of wiggle my octagon around in the hyperbolic plane, but keeping the combinatorics of the side identifications the same, keeping lengths of opposite sides the same, keeping the angle sum equal to 2 pi, and I get a whole deformation space of hyperbolic surfaces that are a priori distinct, that are a priori not pairwise isometric. And well, turns out that you can make this formal, and what you get is that you get a whole moduli space MG, which is so the space of oriented closed hyperbolic surfaces of genus G, for instance, surfaces of genus G considered up to orientation preserving isometries. I'm adding all the orientations in there to make it consistent with Riemann surfaces. And it turns out, so just to give you some idea, this thing is, okay, so again, this space contains all these deformations of my octagon. in the case of genus 2. And it turns out that this has this naturally has the structure of a 6G minus 6 dimensional orbifold. Okay, so what's an orbifold? It's a space that is a manifold almost everywhere. So it's locally homeomorphic to R6G minus 6 almost everywhere, except at the locus of positive codimension where it looks like a cone. So the quotient of some Rn by a finite group. I'm saying this just to make the point that even if I fix the topology, there are plenty of different hyperbolic metrics. So you should think of this as an analog to the moduli space of lattices before that I mentioned, like the moduli space of distinct flat metrics on the torus has exactly the same structure. I mean, it is some finite dimensional orbifold. Okay, so in particular, well, you can ask all sorts of questions. You can ask the same type of extremal problems. We're going to talk about the Laplacian, so let me introduce that. So the Laplacian, again, it's a Riemannian manifold, so it has a Laplacian minus the divergence of the gradient in the hyperbolic plane. So let's say in local coordinates in the hyperbolic plane, it just looks like minus y squared times the usual Euclidean Laplacian, d squared dx squared plus d squared dy squared. Okay, and so I'm going to consider closed surfaces. So in particular, the closed Riemannian manifold. So there's a spectral theorem for the Laplacian that tells you that the spectrum consists of eigenvalues in this case. So spectrum. My closed for me includes connected. So spectrum of delta on 2x consists of eigenvalues 0, starting at 0, corresponding to constant functions. This thing still annihilates constant functions. And then the rest is strictly positive. So there's lambda 1 of x, and then that one might have multiplicity. But it's discrete, the spectrum, which includes the statement that every eigenvalue has finite multiplicity, and so on and so forth. Some countable set. It's spectra, and is discrete. So, okay. So just like in the... and also just like in the case of tori, even if this a priori somewhat analytical quantity, there's lots of geometric interest in this number too. You can think of this as some sort of measure of connectivity of your surface. The larger this number is, the more connected your surface. It also influences the dynamics of the geodesic flow. If this is larger, then the geodesic flow on the hyperbolic surface is always chaotic. It mixes, and the bigger this number, the faster it mixes. It also shows up in error estimates for counting geodesics on the surface. So there's lots of, even if it's somewhat analytical quantity, there's lots of geometric interest in it. Okay, so that was all that I wanted to say about sort of introduction to hyperbolic surfaces. Are there any questions at this point? If not, then okay, let's look at base notes. So maybe the most natural family, before I talk about arithmetic surfaces, maybe the most natural family to look at is just all closed hyperbolic surfaces. So I take all closed hyperbolic surfaces, I take their lambda ones, get some set of real numbers. What does this look like? So also there's lots of work on this, hyperbolic surfaces. We know almost everything. There's one thing left to figure out. So this theorem, so it combines the work of a lot of people, starting in the 70s, basically with Huber, Rui Cheng, Boozer, dot, 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 and then Kravchuk, Mazach, and Pal. So this is from 3 years ago. Pal and independently Bonifacio at the same time. That says the following. It says if I take the set of all the base notes, so this is lambda 1, x, x closed hyperbolic surface closed, maybe orientable hyperbolic surface. Then this has, so now, before for arithmetic surfaces, I was closing it off. But this is already an uncountable set. I have these moduli spaces. I have deformation spaces of hyperbolic surfaces. And it has the following structure. So it's just like for tori. It's an interval, half closed. We also know that. Where lambda 2 is the max of lambda 1 of x, x of genus 2. Okay, so it's not trivial that this is a maximum for the same reason as before. So the moduli space mg is not compact. Lambda 1 is a continuous function. But you can even, for systoles, this is different, but for lambda 1, you can even find sequences where lambda 1 does not tend to 0 and where you fly off to infinity. So it's quite subtle, but due to work of Boozer, this is a maximum, at least in the case of genus 2. And up to genus about 20, we know this in general. So let's say, what's the only thing that's missing? We don't know the number lambda 2. So there's a conjecture that it should be exactly the lambda 1 of the Boltzmann surface. Lambda 2 is lambda 1 of the Boltzmann surface, which is roughly 3.84. So how do you prove this? In very big lines. So what you want to show, first of all, what you want to show is that lambda 1 is a continuous function. It's quite classical that in any moduli space I can make it tend to 0. So as soon as I have hit a certain value in mg, I have a whole interval below it as well. So you want to show that the interval corresponding to M2 covers all the others. So in words, what am I saying is that you want to show that the bigger the drum, the lower the bass note, right? This is so intuitively it's somewhat reasonable. So this goes, so Huber and Cheng, they have general bounds on what happens in high genus. So what the lambda 1 of a high genus surface can be, and it turns out that if the genus gets large, lambda 1 cannot be a lot larger than the bottom of the spectrum of the hyperbolic plane, which is a quarter, so that's well below 3.84. And then in low genus, you need something else. And there, this is where sort of this more recent work comes in. In particular, we do know, due to the work of these people, that lambda 2 is pretty close to lambda 1 of the Boltzmann surface. So up to, I forgot literally how many, but up to at least 3 digits, it coincides. So this is why the Boltzmann surface is quite a natural conjecture. Okay. So let me talk about arithmetic surfaces. So it's a family of hyperbolic surfaces that, again, there's many, before I talk about hyperbolic arithmetic surfaces, there's many other natural families of hyperbolic surfaces you can look at. There's many cases where we know a large part of the answer. For instance, you could replace closed by finite area. You could, instead of surfaces, you could look at orbifolds. There's a lot to say and a lot known, but.
It's not here why you denoted base index 2?
Just for dimension 2. Just you can also ask it for hyperbolic 3 manifolds. Then again, it's a countable set, but the. That's confusing. Yes. Okay. I'll stick to it, but you're right.
So the definition of base 2 is for all genera?
All genus at the same, all genera at the same time, all closed hyperbolic surfaces. If it's the ball, exactly. It's known it's achieved because, so Boozer proved that if you go close, if you diverge in moduli space, there are going to be a lot of eigenvalues just above a quarter. So as soon as you know that there is one with an eigenvalue strictly above a quarter, you know that it's a maximum, which we know up to genus roughly 20. So that proves it's a maximum. We just don't know which surface it is. And then we also know, due to these bounds in low genus, we know, so there's conjecture, there's also in genus 3, for instance, there's another surface that admits a similar definition to the Boltzer surface, namely the Klein quartic, which is the unique Riemann surface of genus 3 with 168 automorphisms. It's also the most symmetric surface in genus 3. And conjecturally, that maximizes lambda 1 in genus 3, and its lambda 1 is roughly 2.67, so it's well below the Boltzer surface already. So we know that.
Does this correspond to like conical points in the moduli space?
Yes, conical points in the moduli space come exactly from automorphisms of the surface of the underlying surfaces. So yes, and also the Boltzer surface. It's the most. I didn't say that, but. So there's a classical theorem due to Hurwitz that the number of automorphisms is at most 84 times g minus 1. It's not realized in every genus. Klein quartic is the lowest genus where it's realized, and the Boltzer surface is the most symmetric surface in genus 2, which has only 48, which is less than Hurwitz's bound predicts. Okay, arithmetic surfaces. Okay, so this is the last word of the title that I haven't defined yet. Arithmetic surfaces. So these are special type of hyperbolic surfaces that pop up very often. So they're sort of a natural interest. So what's an arithmetic surface? It's a surface X. Is called arithmetic if the group gamma is arithmetic. Okay, so my arithmetic if gamma in PSL2R. I didn't say this, but the orientation preserving isometries of H2 can be identified with PSL2R. So 2x2 matrices with real coefficients, determinant 1 considered up to a sign. Is arithmetic. So now I need to define what an arithmetic group is, and well, talks about arithmetic groups can be a bit frustrating because no one ever gives you the definition, and I'm afraid this talk will be no different. So here are some examples of arithmetic groups. So people always like to say is, you should think of the canonical example is the integer points in some Lie group. So a nice example in PSL2R is PSL2Z, and that's an arithmetic group. R. So this is again. What's nice about putting Z in is that you get discreteness for free. Right. Again, I wanted a quotient of the plane by a discrete and torsion-free group for a surface. This group is discrete. It's not torsion-free because it contains elements of order 2 and 3, but there are finite index subgroups that are torsion-free. For instance, congruence groups, principal congruence groups. And arithmeticity is a property that is preserved by taking finite index subgroups. So let me say, and its finite index subgroups. So that's example number one. And then I didn't have it on the board anymore. So again, let me, the Bolzer surface is an example of an arithmetic surface. So how do you see the, forgot to say that. I told you how to see the Bolzer surface as something that is locally isometric to the hyperbolic plane. You can also see it as the quotient of the hyperbolic plane by group. You just need to write down isometries that pair these sides in the pattern that I wanted. So you have four isometries that map these sides to each other. So you get some finitely generated group, the group generated by these four isometries. So XB, I'm going to write it as H2 mod gamma B. And gamma B is also an arithmetic group, as are its finite index subgroups. Okay. And finite index subgroups. Okay, so these are all the examples I'll give. I also claim that it's not so bad for this particular talk, because again, the goal was to explain the fact that if I take the lambda ones of all arithmetic surfaces, I get a dense set in 0 to 1/4. And actually, what we prove is that you actually, subgroups of these suffice. So Michael McGee, he proves it, he uses these. These are non-co-compact, so you get hyperbolic surfaces with cusps. You get and these are all co-compact. What Will and I do is we show that with subgroups of these alone, you can get a dense subset between 0 and 1/4. So for us, that's fine as a definition for arithmetic groups. So what do we expect for this? So there's a conjecture in, for instance, in Sarnak's notes, it's called Selberg plus Epsilon. Sarnak. So Selberg's conjecture states that specific subgroups of these groups here, they have lambda 1 greater or equal to 1/4. And so if you assume plus epsilon, namely greater than 1/4, that you can realize greater to 1/4 infinitely often, you get the following conjecture. If I take the base node spectrum of the set of two-dimensional hyperbolic arithmetic surfaces, lambda 1 arithmetic hyperbolic surface. So again, even if I allow non-compact surfaces, it's still a countable set. So there's basically no hope of describing it entirely, but if you take the closure, the conjecture is that this has the structure of, you take the interval 0 to 1/4, there you should be able to realize everything. And there's another set, E. So that's the plus epsilon part, with E is a subset in the interval, so 1/4 infinity, so eigenvalues strictly above 1/4, which is countable, upper bounded, and discrete subset. The discrete is sort of automatic, but let me say subset. Before, when I wrote down the theorem all the way on the left on the board, I said that Huber and Cheng, they proved that if the area of the surface gets large, the spectral gap cannot be a lot, the first eigenvalue cannot be very much above 1/4. There's only finitely many, if I put a cap on the area, there's only finitely many arithmetic hyperbolic surfaces. So you know that if there's infinitely many, they're going to accumulate onto 1/4. So discreteness comes for free. And so what's missing is, we know it's non-empty because the Bolzer surface, for instance, the lambda one of the Bolzer surface lies here. It's roughly 3.484. The Klein quartic is another example. We have finitely many examples, but we don't know that we can produce infinitely many examples. That's the open part. And again, so that our theorem, so Michael's theorem, And Will and our theorem says that this part of the this part we now know. Okay, so the goal of the
can you repeat what you mean by Selberg?
So Selberg predicts that if you take congruence subgroups that you get lambda 1 greater or equal to a quarter. And if you want this, you need them to be strictly greater than a quarter. Right? If they're constantly equal, then it doesn't help for producing infinitely many points here. This is the only thing. This is the plus epsilon. All right. Are there any questions at this point? Because the goal of the rest of the talk is to explain some ingredients of what goes into the proof of the fact that this, with closed surfaces, you can achieve this. And also, Nalini, until when do I have?
You have 6, 7 minutes.
Okay. All right. Perfect. All right. So, proof idea. So, what's the idea? The idea, first of all, is to use randomness. So what we're going to do is we're going to, in both of the approaches, we're going to take random finite degree covers of X, which corresponds to random finite index subgroups of these. So these are of gamma B. So these are still arithmetic surfaces. And we want to prove that with these random ones, we can roughly do what we want. So there's one issue. So what's nice in the non-compact case is that if you start not with PSL2Z, but with a group without torsion, then it's a free group. The fundamental group is free, which makes it much easier to understand random finite index subgroups. Gamma B here is a surface group. So just in words, there's a relation between these generators. And this makes the combinatorics harder. This is the problem. So, goal, let me, okay. Random, use random finite index subgroups of gamma B. And how are we going to build them? Let me draw some pictures on the board. So I want the first thing, so here's a topological picture of the Bolzer surface. The first thing I want to do is I want to get rid of the combinatorial complication. I want to go back to free groups. And what's the observation is that if I draw this floating in R3, then it's, I can think of this as the boundary of a regular neighborhood of a wedge of two circles, of a graph in R3. And in particular, that means that the fundamental group gamma B admits a surjection onto the fundamental group of that graph, which is F2. Okay, and let's see, and the kernel is what? So this has a huge kernel because this is not a free group. And what's the kernel? The kernel corresponds to a certain regular cover of the Bolzer surface. And it's just a regular cover that looks like the graph cover. So what's the cover corresponding to the graph? The cover corresponding to the graph is just a universal cover of the graph. So here it is. This is a four-valent tree. And so on and so forth. And then what's the cover, corresponding cover for the Bolzer surface? I just have to draw the surface around the graph the same way that was drawn here. So this means I draw a surface around my graph like this, and then you have to imagine that it continues into an infinite four-valent tree, right? Okay. So that's my cover. And now what can I do? What's nice is now that using this surjection, it's very easy to produce random finite index subgroups. You just take a random surjection onto Sn. If I think of this as generated by A and B, then a map from F2 to Sn is just, what do I need to do? To pick a homomorphism, I just need to describe the images of the generators, right? Because everything else is a word in the generators. And that could just come, since there's no relation, that just comes down to picking two permutations at random, right? And then what does my cover look like? So maybe, let me draw, maybe n is equal to 4. Then if I draw out these permutations like this, maybe pi A does this and pi B does something like this, right? So you should think of these things as labeled 1 up to 4. Maybe pi B does this, has two fixed points like that. Right. This picture describes two permutations. This gives me a graph cover, and this thing here, If I project, let's say, in the horizontal direction, this gives me a cover of a wedge of two circles. This gives me an intermediate cover between the tree and the finite graph around which I've drawn my surface. And again, hence also a surface cover. So algebraically, if let's say if this is number 1, 2, 3, and 4, the fundamental group of this cover is, so I get a subgroup here, let's say Hn, which corresponds to, what is this? This is all the words, the fundamental group here is all the words in A and B, and A inverse, B inverse. The fundamental group here is the same, except I need that it closes up again. So what is that in terms of permutations? Just a stabilizer under phi of 1, right? Or of 2, if you want. Okay, so I get this random cover. And now, what can we say about the random cover? We know that we know by combining work of Bordenave and Collins and Collins with work by Hyde and McGee, both of which I think we'll hear about a little bit tomorrow, and also about generalization. So I think Ramon and Michael will talk about generalizations of this, and maybe also some of this. Also Julien Moy, who's in the audience, has proved generalizations of this. What does it say? It says that improbability, the lambda 1 of my random cover, yn is going to be the hyperbolic plane mod this subgroup, hn. This tends to the lambda, the base of the bottom of the spectrum of this t here. Okay, this is t here. All right, so what we're going to do, and then I guess I'm out of time. First of all, we need to understand what lambda naught of t is, because it's no longer the hyperbolic plane. So for this, we're going to use a beautiful theorem due to Mirzakhani, which we put in as follows. So first of all, I said I have a surjection to a free group. I actually have tons of surjections to a free group, because what can I do? I have this attachment of my surface to the boundary of this graph. I can precompose with the self-homeomorphism of the surface. And this a priori, this changes the surjection onto the free group. I have an action of the mapping class group of the surface here. So let me add k phi, where phi is, let's say, a self-homeomorphism of the surface, for instance. Let me just call it the mapping class. Self-homeomorphism considered up to isotopy of the Boltzmann surface here. So this also gives me a tree t phi. The geometry of this tree changes if I change the attachment of my surface onto the boundary here. And now, what do we do? So we, using an argument based on Cheeger's inequality, we say the following. So let me just draw my surface here, otherwise I keep walking back and forth. So, bum, 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 bum. So my surface, let me draw some what is called a Pantz decomposition on the surface. So a collection of simple closed curves. So the complement of the surface consists of three whole spheres, pairs of Pantz. This is a hyperbolic surface. These have lengths, let's say L1, L2, and L3. And this lifts, I can lift this Pantz decomposition to a countable collection of curves in my tree, and so on and so forth, which have exactly the same length. By construction. And Cheeger's inequality implies that actually, if these lengths are very long and not too far away from each other, then the spectral gap, the lambda naught here, is close to a quarter. Okay, so this is the. So if L1, L2, L3 long and close to each other, I won't make this rigorous, to each other. Lambda naught of t phi is roughly a quarter, minus some epsilon, which you can control in terms of this length. Right, these fancy compositions, they're special. They consist of what is called meridians, curves that contract when I go onto the free group. And then, so now Mirza-Hani's theorem. Mirza-Hani proved the following thing. She proved that if I fix my favorite Pan's decomposition, so three curves on my surface, such that the complement consists of spheres with three boundary components. She proved that if I take PL uniformly at random among Pan's decompositions in the mapping class group orbit of my base Pan's decomposition, MC, so homeomorphic to this base Pan's decomposition MCG XB, among those with total length at most L. Okay, then what can I look at? I can look at the lengths of these three curves, right? So L of PL. Which is, so this is, again, if you're not so used to hyperbolic geometry, maybe this is a finite set, the number of Pan's decompositions with total bounded length. So this is the length of these three curves. And I divide by the total length, L alpha 1 plus L alpha 2 plus L alpha 3. Okay, so this is now, what is this? This is a three-dimensional vector with some one, right? Positive numbers of some one. So this is a random variable in the simplex in R3. And, okay, so now I'll stop because I'm probably already well over time. But the what does she prove? That the distribution of this converges as L tends to infinity to an explicit distribution. We need much less than what she actually proves, but so let's say nu L tends in distribution as L tends to infinity to some new infinity. What's important for us is that it's absolutely continuous with respect to the Lebesgue measure on the simplex. There's mass in the middle. So in particular, you have very long Pan's decompositions where three curves have roughly the same length. So you get a tree with a very good spectral gap. So you get a sequence of random covers whose spectral gap is still very good. So I'm still nowhere. Now I still need to now I need to fill up the rest of the interval. And what's the trick there? The trick is to look at further degree two covers of my random cover. So among those, you again using basically the same technology, you prove there's at least one that has a very good spectral gap. There's also one that has a really bad spectral gap, namely I just take a disjoint cover, two disjoint copies, and then you show that there's some move on the set of degree two covers, so that you that is sort of that such that between any pair of degree two covers of my random cover, I can perform a finite sequence of moves to get from one to the other, and then you prove that one move doesn't change the spectrum too much, and then you get that the collection of lambda ones you get is dense enough. Okay, and that's for another time. Thank you very much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.